a public hearing session on the Board of Nursing's budgets is House Bill 5052 and 5053. And then we will also, before the day's out, we'll have a hopefully a work session on Senate Bill 5521, which will be Board of Medical Examiners. So if we can invite up our key people from the nurses.
Almost forget what they are.
We have a need for additional information, and there is certain concern over three areas that we, although we've kind of discussed them, we want to rehash them in greater detail. And they deal with the requests for additional personnel and for approval of the lease agreement. And so
good morning.
Yes, we'd like to do that. So you're going to be here for a short time, is that right? Okay. So we'd like to adjourn. No, we want to take a brief recess of this public hearing and go ahead and have a work session on Senate Bill 5521.
We're not going to be down for a week.
Join us for a minute. So I'm going to recess this public hearing on the State Board of Nursing, and this time we'll convene a work session on the Board of Medical Examiners budget, which is Senate Bill 5521.
Mr. Chairman. Move House Bill.
Senator Carter.
Well, we need a few details here.
Well, she's going to make the motion, then we're going to get the debate and discussion.
Yeah, who's running this committee?
Well, the chair is, but
okay,
traditionally,
Mr. Chair,
the way it really works is LFO makes a recommendation.
Okay. Why don't we first turn some time over to Deborah Manthey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And at your places, you should have a packet of information. It has a memo on the cover, and then attached to it, you'll find a work session action report that looks like this, and that's the document we're going to walk through, as well as some performance measure information in a separate form, and we'll also walk through that. The work session action form, the first part of it walks through how the governor's, kind of the major chunks of the governor's printed budget.
Major chunks.
We start with the approved budget for this biennium. We had $213,000 roughly of base adjustments. These are primarily PERS rate adjustments and health insurance benefit adjustments. There were three essential packages that that BAM and the agency talked to you about, and they total $172,803. These are primarily, again, some pension bond contribution adjustment and an IT phase-out and some inflation. There are policy packages totaling $342,462, two positions, 1.9 FTE in the governor's recommended budget. The next section of the report then will walk through each policy package and go through what the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation is. Now, the reason I'll just interrupt myself. The reason this particular action report is larger than what you might normally see is because the Board of Medical Examiners has two decision units. In talking to the chair, we decided not to go through each decision unit, but to do the agency as a total. So we'll really just go through the first two pages. The rest of the information has more detail on the packages if you needed to or wanted to refer to, as does the memo. So package 090, this is the 16,000 of this is the agency share of the smart buy savings. Again, you'll probably see this in virtually every budget that comes before you. And then there's also a $75,000 reduction to reflect current biennium underspending for a total of $91,169, a reduction. And our recommendation is to approve that. Package 101, compliance and investigation workload. in the governor's budget, recommended budget, it's in there for $127,838, one position, 1.2 FTE. This establishes an investigator three position and increases a part-time support position to full-time in response to an increase in workload. Since 1998, workload has increased 75%, and staffing has increased only 11%. The agency has exhausted process efficiencies and automation efforts and is now requesting an increase in FTE.
Can I ask a question on that one?
Sure. Senator Carter.
Tell me about the 91-169. You're reducing this amount, even
yes,
though they're saying they have an increase in... Can you just explain that for me?
Package 090 is a reduction, and it's for the Smart Buy savings,
okay,
and to reflect that they were underspending this biennium. So the Department of Administrative Services reduced their budget by $75,000.
Okay.
Their governor's their agency request budget.
Okay, okay. Got it. Now, and package 101?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
It would be this one.
Gotcha. The workload's up 75%, and their
staffing's only
up. FTE is up 11.
11.
Okay, I'm there. Okay.
Sticker maker? Need.
It might be... It might have included a central package by the agency. 030-06-09.
We have a provision in here.
All right.
That
so the recommendation or the reduction that you see to this package is for the PERS rate reduction. The PERS rate in the GRB is 15.52%, and now it's being reduced to, I lost my place.
No, we'll stop here.
We're on 102.
14.63. It's a 0.89% reduction in the rate. So, and again, you're going to see this in every budget, every policy package that had a position, and base adjustments as well.
Okay.
So that's the only adjustment that I've recommended to this package. Package 102, originally in the governor's recommended budget, this was to change the eligibility requirements for their health professionals program to include mental health diagnosis. As you recall, the agency has withdrawn the package, although if memory serves, they're committed to bringing this back after some things have been worked out. So they're still committed to this idea. It's just we're not going to do it this finding. So they've withdrawn it, and that left $16,447 for an increase in rent. We are recommending that you approve $8,228. I've reduced it by $8,219 after working with the agency. They had some limitation in other areas to offset the whole increase. Package 103 is the criminal background check. The agency is requesting that a limited duration half-time position be established to help get the program up and going. The majority of this package is to be able to process through Oregon State Police background checks on all new applicants and certain licensees perhaps under investigation. Our recommendation is to approve the package. There's actually a decrease and an increase here. We've reduced it by $208 to reflect the PERS rate reduction on the part-time position. And we've increased the special payment to OSP by $28,800 to reflect the March 05 rate increase. At the time the governor's recommended budget was put together, I believe the fingerprint fee for the Oregon State Police was like $36, and that's what they built their budget on. And since then, the fee has gone up. And so we've recommended that they get an increase. That takes us to 801 package.
Mr. Chair, before we move on, just want to make a note for the record on package 102. I'm still concerned about this, and I want to highlight that in the future, the next biennium, and this looks at looked at very carefully. The stress factors on physicians are growing. Depression, anxiety issues are getting worse, and that means risk to patient care. seeing more positions going to part-time, more positions retiring early, and I think it's a growing issue that I don't want forgotten. Obviously, we'll accept this package, but in the future, want that brought back. I think it's an issue that's going to be important to us, and it's going to directly relate to, I'm afraid, to addiction abuses mm-hmm. and other things of that nature, which we'll see cropping up. Physicians are pretty famous for self-administering drugs when they're depressed or anxious. It's a bad habit, but it leads to those problems. So just a word of caution on that as well.
But Mr. Chairman, I support that because my doctor I had to retire this year because of high level of anxiety and drug connection. And so it just mimics society. I don't know why we would think doctors and nurses would be any different than what is happening in society at large when it comes to these kind of issues. And I think that to keep more people in the workforce, because there are people who work with problems of anxiety and they just transition into other areas in their own profession. So I think it's something for us to take a good look at, and I'm hoping that you guys as associations are taking that into consideration, that we're talking about human beings who provide a service, and so anxiety is going to always be higher, and think about what do we do to protect the safety of the individual as well as the safety of the clients they serve, and that's really an important thing. So thank you, Dr. Bates, for bringing that up, because I really wanted to say something about that too, but felt as if, because I'm not a professional in the medical community, I didn't know, you know, how that would be taken.
I appreciate that.
Well, I think that LFO will make a note of that and mm-hmm. make sure that it comes up as they're preparing the next
program. Physicians are particularly anxious not to be seen going into a psychiatrist's office or going to get treated. All they have is their reputation, and so they have a sense of not wanting to be seen in those situations. But they've got to encourage them to get help.
Yeah, it's a big man thing.
Yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
You know, this fits right in with the work you're doing, looking at a PLF type model for physicians, right. In that the attorneys have as part of their PLF. That staff, which is completely separate from the Bar Association.
Now, those guys are schizophrenic.
Yeah,
they wouldn't need it.
That's a whole different story.
But what they've got is the ability for an attorney who's got problems to call, and it's completely held confidential,
yes,
and they can get help without it affecting their license or anything else, because
right.
they've seen that the goal is to get the help,
exactly.
not to wait until there's a crisis.
That's right.
Yep. I agree. Well, thank. I didn't mean to derail us.
That was good.
And Mr. Chair, we'll make sure that that's reflected in the budget report. 801, the last package. The reduction you see here is, again, for the PERS rate reduction for the base and essential package amounts. I've also requested, it's more of a housekeeping measure, some line items be shifted for the agency to make sure that the budget line items reflect how they're actually spending.
Okay, would you help me find that? I don't see a tab for the last one.
The last one would be, you wouldn't find one in here. These are the adjustments that our office is making.
Okay,
So, Mr. Chair, members, the recommended budget for medical examiners is $7,089,013, 36 positions, 34.3 FTE, which is $145,855 less than the governor's recommended budget, a 2% change. The majority of that is PERS reduction, and of course we've also increased for the fingerprinting fee. If there were no additional questions, we could move on to performance measures.
Performance measures.
Yes, which is a two-page form. I was expecting nursing, and so I was a little surprised how small it was, so I freaked out there for a minute. Again, this form summarizes the performance measures, and we talked about those. And the far right-hand column 9, is it's labeled status of KPM, and that's where I was keeping track of the decisions we talked about in terms of their performance measures. If it says same... for a measure like, for example, measure number one, percentage of board-issued license denials that were upheld upon appeal. It was my recollection that when we discussed this that you were all fine with the targets and with this being a measure that was reported to the legislature. So then I will just hit the ones that I believe we talked about, or you talked about, deleting and keeping internally. And again, for these measures, we discussed that these were important measures for the agency to keep track of, but they didn't necessarily need to be reported to the legislature. And that would be performance measure number two, number of hits on the board's website per month, and measure number four, percentage of participants rating informational presentations by executive staff as good or better. There are two added performance measures at the bottom, measure number 10 and measure number 11. And again, you will see these in virtually every budget that comes before you. These are the two standard customer service measures that will be placed in every agency's budget. So, is that, Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation is a budget of $7,089,013, 36 positions, 34.3 FTE, and that the performance measures be approved as reflected in the form with this review.
Okay. Are there any questions of LFO regarding this review and summary of their recommendations? Seeing none, we can entertain a motion.
Yes, Chair. I move that House Bill 5521 for the Board of Medical Examiners be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
It has been moved by Senator Carter that Senate Bill 5521 be passed as recommended and be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections to this motion?
Mr. Chair, would you like an accurate recommendation?
That it be moved as approved by the LFO examiner.
As recommended by the LFO officer to and include the performance measures to the full committee to pass recommendation.
May the record,
that's what
may the record
Senator
indicate
Carter
there's
wanted.
Been a minor friendly amendment modification of the motion. With that in mind, is there any objection to this friendly amended modified motion? Seeing none, we have here.
Could we characterize a friendly amendment as a relatively picky?
We would like to see if there's any objection to the relatively picky friendly motion, friendly amendment to the motion to move this budget to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection?
Sure.
Seeing none, it is passed.
I need carrier.
Okay.
Ben said he carried on the Senate side.
Okay.
I think that we would ask Senator Westland if he would carry on the Senate side.
I'd be proud, honored, and with pleasure.
Okay.
We need wordy today.
Representative Hansen, would you take it to the full committee?
I'd be excited.
Okay. And Representative Hanna, would you like to carry this to the floor?
That you voted
in the House.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monsanto.
I request that I have the opportunity to vote on this bill.
Okay, we have
with the vote on that.
Well, let's see. Committee members, we would like to suspend the rules and allow Senator Monsanderson to vote on this bill. Is there any objection to suspending the rules and allowing her to end this vote? There is none. So, Senator Monsanderson, how do you vote on Senate Bill 5521?
Yes.
Senator Monsanderson is a yes vote on this
vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, I'd point out that getting a yes vote from a nurse on a doctor is a major accomplishment. Major. Thank you for your vote.
It shows the in-depth information and research and presentation that's been provided by all people.
You guys are so wordy today.
These are the people who really
get paid by the word. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we will terminate adjourn this work session on the Board of Medical Examiners, and we would like to reconvene the public hearing on House Bills 5052 and 5053 relating to the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Okay. All right. I understand. No training already, it's so soon.
See you, sweetheart.
Thank you. Good
morning.
Saturday.
All right.
Very good.
I was not really sure that.
Grow exponentially with mom. We don't know who the best chair is.
If there's any in the public who would like to testify on either House Bill 5052 or 5053, these are the bills relating to the Oregon State Board of Nursing, we would invite you to sign up, and then we will use that as our guidance on how to conduct the remainder of this meeting. Welcome again. We appreciate your patience and your flexibility in allowing us to fully ventilate all aspects, concerns, and information relating to your budget. Before we begin, are there any opening remarks that any of the three of you would like to make before we start asking questions?
Chair Richardson, no, we have no prepared remarks. Okay. It's just here to answer questions.
All right. We would like to discuss the three issues that were mentioned to you before. Why don't we begin with the issue of the additional footage that has been requested. And I haven't opened up my numbers here, but I assume it was like $140,000 of additional budget that was going to be needed to pay that additional rent over the next biennium. Is that correct? Is that number?
Representative Richardson, I'm Pat Miles, business manager. Yes, it was approximately $140,000 in package 101 of our, and that is on page 71 of our budget notebook.
Which tab?
Begins that?
The color?
The program, of the actual budget binder.
Okay.
It is under the program units tab, and it's at page 71 through 76 approximately. The discussion of the rent is on page 72. Okay. The amount is $140,084.
Got it. All right. would you take a few minutes and explain, and this is not just to us, but it's to all of those out in television land who are watching conducting of this meeting, as to why it is appropriate to have that kind of an increase. We have a recommendation for a slight increase in number of people. What is your current footage that you have presently? Leading to what kind of increase we're looking at?
Yes. I just wanted to find my exact notes, if you don't mind.
4,100?
Now that's new. I'm wondering where they're at presently.
Here we are.
Before the adjustment.
Representative Richardson, our current rent, we are paying for 11,985 square feet. Of that, we are physically occupying 8,739 square feet.
Okay, so you want to increase your footage by roughly 40% or almost 40%.
Yes, sir.
From 8,700 to
it's approximately that amount. When we first occupied the square footage that we're currently occupying, we had, I believe, 34 positions. At this moment, we have 40 permanent positions, and we are asking for additional positions. I'm sure we'll be talking about. Part of that square footage is a large conference room that is used by other people in the building, but it grew accordingly. So,
is that amount of that large conference room that would be used by other people in the building part of the 4,100 total square feet or part of the 3,000 usable square feet?
That conference room is actually part of the current square footage that we have.
and it's about 2,000 square feet. So when we talk about where the offices are, we are occupying approximately in the high 6,000 to maybe 7,000 square feet. We are currently without any storage space. This 6,500 to 7,000, which I'm sorry, I don't have it all broken down, is almost entirely office space. We do have a few interview rooms.
Now, you lost when you started mentioning a 6,000 number. You said 8,739 feet of usable space presently. But where?
Right, 8,739 square feet are occupied by the board and by no other agency. But included in that 8,700 square feet is a very large conference room. That room obviously won't change with this. So the increase to space is for increased office space and small interview rooms.
Okay. So what you're saying is that there's a conference room already included in 8,739, so understand that. So if you take that out, you presently have 37 employees, is that right?
67.
We currently have 40 permanent employees.
You've got 40 employees, and you want to increase your footage by 40%. Actually, it's more than that now because you took 2,000 out of that 87 because that's a conference room. So now we're down to 67, and you want 3,000 more, so you want a 50% increase in footage, and you're hoping to increase your staff by two people, actually, and because you already have limited positions.
Mr. Chair, can I provide some background to this first? And I'm going to make a comparison. When you go into the Board of Medical Examiners office, you walk in, plush carpet, nice woodworking, and you can't find anyone. When you walk into the Board of Nursing office, you see them crowded. I won't say they working in closets, but all of these women and some one man, two, four or five men, working like busy beavers and cramped
not that
space. And so I sort of wanted to put it in context. Does the Board of Medical Examiners own
that past legislatures have been dilatory in their supervision of the medical examiners, but really what we want to do is focus on the nursing's requirement or request for 50% increase in their footage.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and also when you look at pay equities regarding directors of the Board of Medical Examiners who supervise far fewer people or oversee far fewer physicians, if you compare their director's salary with the nurse's director's salary that covers far more people in physicians, there's a vast discrepancy. So I just wanted to put everything in context before we get too hard on our Board of Nursing.
I'm trying to decide if your comments are a criticism of the lackadaisical attitude of supervision we've exercised over the Board of Medical Examiners or a
just
support
to
for this.
Just to put in context and comparing the various boards, I think there's an inequity among all of them. And so when the Board of Nursing is asking for an increase, it would be nice if we even took a tour of some of these boards that we're making decisions about to get it all in context. That's the only point.
I appreciate that. You know, and realize I certainly am not the only one that's interested in this issue, but since I'm kind of leading out on it, if the Board of Medical Examiners had come in and asked for a 50% increase in their space, then they also would have to be accounting for where they're at and why they want to go where they're at.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot of inequity in what's going on, and it's up to us to keep coming back so that over time we can help that to be resolved. But what we're really trying to do here is to justify for the people, the nurses who are paying for this, these increases, the justification for it, because once they're done, then 2 years from now you come back and it's, you know, they only expand. It goes only.
And Chair Richardson, I'd like to expand a little bit. That this additional space will also give us more interview rooms. We're very short on interview rooms right now. So this space will give us more of that. And right now, all our IT equipment is in one small closet. When it gets hot in the summer, we have a fan to try to keep it cool enough so that we don't have damage to our equipment. This additional space will also help us, give us more room for our IT equipment, which supports the whole fourth floor and 10 other regulatory boards. So it's not just offices that we're asking for.
We could have our LFO advisor, Ms. Manthe, discuss the... What took place in the last session regarding IT and the packages back then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may need some help from Pat Miles. What we're looking at is in your budget from last time, you had package 104 and it was titled Office Reconfiguration, where it identified one-time expenditures to reconfigure existing space. And in it identifies modifying heating and air conditioning systems to properly cool your computer equipment. So is that, and when I looked at the expenditures, Mr. Chair, it appeared to be more expendable property and capital kind of investments. It wasn't an increase in space. And so I'm wondering if Ms. Miles could comment on the difference between these two proposals.
Chair Richardson, maybe I can just step through this very quickly, the timeline, because I think that's what's causing the confusion. We planned for a reconfiguration of office space that is existing occupied in the year 2001. That's when we planned to create the call center. And in that, we fixed the conference room and we fixed the call center area. The floor plan then called for fixing the problems that we have right now in our current workspace. The estimates that were brought forth and put into Package 104 last biennium were simply construction and systems furniture for cubicles within that space. Again, that happened in 2001. When we sat down to actually start the planning at the beginning of this biennium for what we called phase three, and we tried to put all the cubicles for all the people in there and sufficient interview rooms and applied DAS standards to them, it became very apparent to DAS as well as to us that there wasn't sufficient space with walkways, filing areas, interview rooms. So we worked with DAS on what is an appropriate amount of space, and that is what's in here. The actual cost of renovation and the actual cost of the workstations is being paid for out of the current biennium. It is the increased actual footage that will happen in future bienniums that we're asking for. So the amount that was in Package 104 goes away on June 30th and was only intended as a one-time purchase. We did not intend in 2001 that we would have to get more floor space. If we had, we would have come to you then.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers, and I may be wrong, so LFO help out. I did write a quick calculation of number of employees and usable space you have, this kind of size for the conference room. I've got you down at about 110 square feet per employee, something of that nature. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, that is correct. We have people sharing cubicles. And we have people in
how you're jamming.
We have substandard cubicles, and we only have two interview rooms that everyone competes for.
I'm looking at, when you think of hallways, bathrooms, space for files, your IT equipment. Are there laws involved in fire hazards? Are there laws involved in a minimum space for work? I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me. The numbers don't make any sense to me. The numbers are too small. I mean, you must be down to cubicles that are 6-7 feet by 6-7 feet? I don't know. What do they look like?
Representative Hanna has a comment on your question.
Yeah.
Senator Bates, I would suggest that, and I'm not sure the math you went through here, but
I may be wrong. I'm just doing this real quick.
You have close to 12,000 square feet, of which 8,739 is their usable space. 2,000 of that is the conference room, the difference of which is that common area that they pay for, which would be restrooms, hallways, common space in a building. So they're already paying for a significant space of common area within this structure. But if you take the usable space of 8,739 less 2,000 for the conference room, 6,739 and 40 employees, I come up still at like 170 square feet. And that's all usable space, not using any of the square footage determination for the common area.
Okay, so with that, what is, do you have clarification for it?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna and Senator Bates, we have a situation where some of the cubicles have been in place for, well, ever since we moved into the building. They're very odd shapes and fairly small. Some cubicles are slightly bigger. We have a lot of space that's taken up by storage and the legal, if you will, passageways. The DAS standards were actually adopted after occupation of the Portland State Office Building. And as we do anything, we have to work within those. And they seek to standardize everything. I'm sorry, I just went blank.
Are you meeting the DAS standards or above or below?
Currently, we do not meet DAS standards in most areas. There are some cubicles that are too large and some that are too small.
So its configuration is...
It is a large part of it, yes.
Okay, Ms. Matthew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, when DAS came in and did their analysis, did they provide you a document or something that maybe we could share that with the chair and the subcommittee that talked about why you needed more square footage and the standards and... No?
Actually, what happens is each agency submits to DAS with using their forms who they think needs to be in the space, at what levels they work. There's different standards for management and non-management, and if some people need more storage space because of the files that they work with. And it's more of a checklist. We submitted those criteria, if you will, to them, and they approved it back. So they didn't necessarily provide the analysis. They rely on the agency to do so. And I will say that a large part of what justified the extra space, because you're right, you draw the little cubicles and you think it's all going to fit. The Portland State Office Building is a very odd shape. It has four sides to it, but they're very odd, so you can't just draw lines and make things fit. They also have large pillars that you have to work around. But it was the additional space needed for the large number of files with 65,000 licenses. We have a lot of files, even though we're working to try to image those things, and the amount of work we do with interviews, needing to have 4 to 5 interview rooms that are dedicated to do interviews and not to do regular meetings. We needed meeting space as well so that managers can talk together and make policy decisions. Those things all kind of added up, if you will, to the larger space. It wasn't, I can't say this is the one thing that justifies this space. We can say that we only have, besides the large conference room, we have 3 rooms that are available to have interviews and all meetings in. And when we, for example, in 2 weeks we have a hearing going on, we can't do any other business because we need those rooms to put witnesses in awaiting the hearing. So we have all other business comes to a halt when we don't have those kinds of spaces. And that's really the bottom line for us. And Chair Richardson, we do have blueprints that we would be glad to share with you.
Okay.
But I also want to clarify that this, the reconfiguration will be paid for in this biennium, and what we're asking for the next biennium is just the rent for this increased space.
Okay, I understand. Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to be term picky today because we've heard that already. But I'm a little confused.
Phase two, and we're supposed to.
Because I have heard now that we don't have storage room and we do have storage room, and that's. We need to decide if we do or we don't. That's one issue. And the second thing is, and I said this in the earlier hearing, you need to check with DAS on this, because in my limited but experience with commercial buildings, you're currently paying for some 27% of your rent in common space, period. It would not be unusual in commercial building space to have a common area rent factor of 12 to 15%. Go look at commercial buildings and little office structures on the private sector, and you'll find that people don't like to pay for space they don't get to use. They understand you're going to pay for a restroom and that kind of thing, but that concerns me that DAS is really into them for, 27% of your space is, you're paying the same rate for that space
We have Jim Gores here from DAS, it would probably be appropriate for you to step up if you would. We're grilling the wrong people.
Yeah.
Unless you're on the right person.
Would you identify yourself?
Jim Gores with DAS Budget Management. As far as space goes and the rent issue and all those, I would defer to DAS facilities on that. There are standards that I checked out while I was doing analysis on these folks. They are, in many cases, tighter than they should be. They're definitely at the bottom of the DAS standards.
Okay, a couple of areas. We're not talking at this point about their space. We're talking about the exorbitant amount of rent that you're charging them. The requirements are $1.40 a square foot for basic.
Correct.
If the commercial acceptable standard for common area is 12%, and DAS is forcing them to pay 28% or to buy 28%, then the difference, which is some 16%, is an additional rent increase that they're having to pay, but it's a hidden rent increase.
Right.
And so we're wondering, why would DAS do that to them when we have a standard of $1.40 a foot?
Representative Richardson, once again, I can't answer that. That's a management decision made by DAS facilities, which I am not part of in any way. I understand your concern, but I don't have an answer for that, unfortunately.
Okay, we have another question. Is part of the common area that they will be buying this area that's presently on the first floor that used to be for child care?
Yes.
Am I correct that the pharmacy group will be renting all or part of that space?
There is, in the plans right now, providing ways and means support and approval, there is a plan to move them down there.
Will there be a rent decrease then for the nursing once they no longer have to pay for that space because you have another source of rent?
It is my understanding that there would be, but I don't know for sure.
There should be.
There should be. But
Chair Richardson, maybe I can clarify. Currently, the percentages, if I can say, 73% is the occupied space. That's what we've been talking about. The floor common is 16%, which is much more in line with commercial rates, and that makes sense. You have bathrooms, you have hallways, et cetera. The building common is 11%. When I talk to DAS about what is going to be our rent bill when we take over this square footage, they couldn't give me an exact amount. That's why we continued with the same percentage. I believe, and they can prove me wrong, most of the first floor of our building is not occupied by a tenant. Now, that we hope is going to change as Board of Pharmacy moves down there, and I believe their space there is about 2,000 square feet. But the footprint of the building, that whole first floor,
has got to be about 15,000 square feet. So it will go down, a percentage of that will go down. I don't know if it's going to go down 1% or 2% or what. We simply had to go with the best knowledge we had at this time. But because it's a public building, they have large conference rooms that the tenants use and other entities, public entities. So I think that's maybe the difference between a commercial building where they might charge people who are using the large conference rooms. They don't charge in our building for conference rooms. And so we are, as part of the public goodwill, paying for these rooms. And we do use them also.
Okay. You've answered my questions. I think the idea is for us to have enough information out in the record so that the co-chairs can consider whether or not they want to approve DAS's contracting arrangements by allowing the full amount of this increase in rent. Are there other questions? Senator Wesson.
Where are you guys located?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, we are located on the fourth floor of the Portland State Office Building, Suite 465.
What are your office hours?
Right.
Sir, our office hours, we have our front door open from 8 until 4:30 with no time off for lunch. It's continuous for 8.5 hours.
I think some of us will be taking a drive, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You wouldn't, Mr. Chair, would you also want to go to the Board of Medical Examiners?
No. The attorneys and the DME, they are appropriately positioned. We know that.
I'm worried about the nurses.
At the time that the BME comes in for additional...
We just passed our budget.
Then we deal with that.
I don't want to
It's too bad
we have plenty of
people
out asking for...
It's gone. Please.
That's why she wanted to handle them first. I should have known. Okay, well, that's fine. That would have been a more interesting conversation had we delayed the budget. But
there's interesting and then there's interesting.
All right. Are there other questions that are relating to the footage? All right. Next issue we'd like to address is the request, request for additional personnel for customer service. Would you please review with us what your request is?
Yes, sir. Packet, also in package 101. We are requesting 2.5 FTE, three positions, be made permanent in the customer service call center. They are at a salary range 15. Two of them are public service representative threes, and one of them is an office specialist two, who currently is in a temporary position, is handling all of the about 27,000 a year renewals that we do. 2 years ago, we asked for these exact same positions. I just want that to be very clear. When we staffed the call center in May of 2002, we had three permanent positions we could put in there, the receptionist and two people who handle the phones. When we came in 2 years ago, we didn't have much history at that time. We had about 6 to 8 months worth of history, and it was decided by this committee that it was most appropriate to staff the call center temporarily to gain some history and see if the staffing level that we proposed was appropriate.
Would you clarify that? Because I'm looking back at the report from the 72nd Legislative Assembly, which is on page 3, after the first tab, saying legislative action.
Yes, sir.
And at the very bottom it says, additionally, the subcommittee eliminated three positions and 2.5 full-time equivalents, but granted equal funding with which the agency is expected to continue to staff the center with non-permanent employees. Why would the last subcommittee eliminate those?
I think it was an unfortunate wording here. They eliminated it from the governor's requested budget, recommended budget. It was they were never in our budget to start with. We were hiring temporary service people prior to that for the first few months. It was simply they eliminated it from the request, not from our actual base budget.
Thank you.
So.
Okay.
So just to clarify, the governor recommended three permanent.
Yes, sir.
And the subcommittee, in the wording in the budget report, wrote that up as an elimination of existing positions, but gave three temporary. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, the actual, and I'm not sure who was here 2 years ago. I know Senator Winters and Carter were both here as well. But
Faith was, he doesn't remember.
Coming back.
I'm sure it is coming back, sir. We asked for several positions last time, and it was a very tight time in state government, and even though we could afford it, it was politically not a very good idea to add that many, and we didn't have history. We admitted we didn't have history. So we looked at what, as an agency, could we have, what could we successfully recruit? It's very hard to recruit an investigator for 2 years. There, people, they have careers that they're not going to put off track for 2 years. But people who work in a call center, there is enough turnover normally that it was decided that was probably an okay employment type situation. And that gave us a chance to get everything up and running sufficiently and start meeting some of our goals that we think we've been making good progress on. So that was really the basis of the decision, that it was apparent there was workload at this time, but we didn't know how that would play out. Also, we didn't know when we would implement e-commerce. We didn't know what the impact would be. We're still kind of in that situation of not knowing how that will play out. But we do know that we have staffed the call center for the last 2 years with these temporary positions, and it's working very well.
Mr. Chair, my memory of this may be flawed, but I hope it's good here. My memory is that there was a backlog building up. Calls weren't getting answered. People were hanging on the line, giving up, calling back in. Just couldn't get through because your workload had increased so much. We had a shortage of nurses. We were not producing and still not producing enough nurses in our own programs, bringing people in and out of the state, all kinds of problems going on. And as a response to that, you wanted to put more people on the phones. And I've been doing it, I think, for a couple of months as we're looking at your budget. At that point in time, we had made a position that we're not going to add any full-time any permanent positions in state government. We were going to hold that down and try to restrict that because we were still going through a terrible recession at that point. And in fact, that was successful. We cut almost 1,000 positions out and held that down. And unfortunately or fortunately, we felt that even other fund budgets should be following the same rules. And so for that reason, as well as this was something kind of new, we wanted you to come back and report to us whether the program is successful, and you take care of your backlog, but you're functioning at a better level. Now is the time for that report. And what I'm hearing you say is that we have taken care of the backlog. We are answering appropriately now. We have data to indicate that these now should become permanent positions. If I'm hearing it correctly, that's what you're trying to tell us. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, that is very accurate.
Thank you.
Okay. I need to have a clarification. The three that were allowed last time were limited duration positions. Would you explain the difference between a temporary position and a limited duration position, and whether or not limited duration positions can be carried over for additional revenue?
Mr. Chair, and not to confuse us anymore, what the agency was given authority for were temporary dollars in their budget, and then with the understanding that administratively, working through the Department of Administrative Services, they would create limited duration positions. Temporary positions, it's a budget amount. It's not like a position count. Limited duration positions can be in a budget and would be a position in FTE count, but no, they do not carry past the biennial period. They automatically go away. And then if you either need, agencies either need to come in and reestablish them, I guess that's their only option, if they need them to continue. But no, limited duration positions do not carry forward in a budget.
Okay. we have two concerns that is why this is coming up. One is that the customer service center during the early part of the last biennium was having 7,000 calls a month, and then as of the first half of 2004, the average had dropped to 5,000 a month, which averages about 238 calls a workday, and so we have a decrease in the number of calls. We also have, as part of the responsibilities, the relicensing of the nurses, which is transitioning into an internet-based process using technology, which means that the amount of time spent in the relicensing process will go down with each relicensing that takes place on the internet as compared to the old way of doing it. And so if you have fewer calls coming in and a more efficient, less time-consuming way to relicense, what is the justification for asking for the same number of people that you're asking for without those two factors?
Chair Richardson, if I could answer the question about renewals first. I asked that very same question to the manager. If the workload goes down for this person, what will happen? And I was told, and I understand that now, right now we are simply, if you will, building widgets. We're trying to get those out as fast as possible. We review, obviously. Quality is job one here. But there are audits that we should be doing. We take the word of licensees on many things. What changes is that we're going to be able to add some quality. We are going to be able to say, well, you said you worked here for the last 2 years, but this doesn't quite come out right. Or you say you took this pain management course. Let's take a look at that. Not to be oppressive to people, but just to keep our eyes on the population. The other thing that's happened is as the volume of calls has gone down, we've added more quality to those conversations. People don't have to call us two and three times. They get all of their questions answered the first time. So we're actually taking a little bit longer with those people to answer all of their needs. And we actually have seen a lot of calls where we're helping people through the e-commerce process. How do I get on? How does this work? People are a little nervous. You know, what is this going to take my money twice or any of those kinds of things? So they're adding quality. And also, we are doing more activities. As staff time gets freed up, they don't just sit there looking out the window, even though it's a nice view to the north. They are being given other tasks that can not compete with the telephone calls, but be complemented by that, such as handling address changes that people have sent in and making sure people get mailings that they need. They take care of all of these staff mailings that they didn't used to. So we have shifted some of those kinds of flexible tasks to those people as appropriate, and we'll continue to do that. And I hesitate to say this, but if we find that we don't need a staff person and we have a vacancy, we will not fill it, and it would go away eventually. We're not in the business of keeping people on for the sake of having people in the agency.
So the short answer is that the quality of service that you could render would increase as the time commitments in some of these other areas decreases.
Yes, sir.
So the full utilization would still be there. Questions, Senator Bates.
Just a couple questions, real quick. When the number of calls go down, do you think some of those calls were redundant calls? In other words, people called in, couldn't get a full answer, cancel the whole thing right now, and now you're taking care of it one call. Is that a possibility?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates. That is one part of it. The other part of it is when we have a backlog of license applications, whether they be renewals or whether they be initial apps, we get more calls. People are checking. They're getting nervous. They want to start working. And the more we stay on top of calls in the call center, the fewer calls the application technicians are handling. They are more caught up in their work. The licensee gets their license before they even thought they were going to get it. The phone call doesn't happen in the first place. And that is our goal.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. How many people do you have in a call center, or more accurately, tell me how many calls the average person takes on an average day?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I can't give you an absolute number of calls in a day. I can tell you, as we've talked before, we probably have an average of 5 people full-time in the call center. One of those individuals is doing renewal processing, and one of them's handling the front desk. So we're talking about probably, for answering the phones, about 3 people, maybe 3.5, in a given day answering. I believe we figured out it's about 4,500 to 5,000 calls in a month, so about 1,000 calls a week, 200. It varies, but approximately that.
You've got, Ms. Chair, so you've got 3.5 people taking 200 calls a day.
That's right. That sounds right to me.
I'd like to hire one of them from my office. Okay. Are they available?
They are excellent employees, sir, and I'm not sure.
What's the likelihood of someone calling in and getting put on hold?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, right now we have an answer rate in the 93 to 95 percentile, I believe. That's just a guesstimate. So most people are getting a real live body.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Richardson, yes. Senator Bates, I just also want to say that some of the calls that we're getting are taking much longer, like the foreign nurses who call in and want to understand how they can get licensed in this state. Those calls take an incredibly long amount of time working through that, you know. And I think the other thing that we've taught our people to say is once they've helped them, they now go the extra step of saying, is there anything else I can do for you today? So it's just adding some quality as well as just answering the phones. Okay.
So we'll go up there. Other questions or comments on this issue? Thank you very much for clarifying that. Mr. Gord, I believe that you've answered all the questions that you can. I appreciate you coming forward.
Yes.
We now would like to turn our attention to the request for investigation enhancement. In the last session, the 72nd legislative session, there was a package 102 which said investigative, and this is on page 4 behind tab 1 for any that want to look at it. But so 2 years ago, this was brought forward, and it says was approved as submitted within the governor's budget, total $305,792. The package expands the board's capacity to review new applicant backgrounds, nurse practice complaints, and best nursing practices. The package adds one full-time advanced practice nursing consultant, one full-time investigator, one part-time, half-full-time equivalent office specialist. And then it says package totals, you know, the $305,000 with 3 permanent positions and 2.5 full FTEs. Did that take place?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kim Coburn. I'm the program executive for compliance investigation with the Board of Nursing. And to answer your questions here, yes, it did, in part. Those positions were the practice nursing consultant was hired as a practice nursing consultant that was not kept, that position was not kept within the investigative area. It was, in fact, not kept in my area. It was converted over to the consultant group that I believe Ms. Bouchard has described to you earlier. The remaining 1.5 are the ones that I mentioned in my testimony. The one full-time investigator position was actually a healthcare advisor/advisor position. That's a position that, as was written, required a nursing degree, and it was essentially what we have, the vast majority of our investigators are. I converted that from a position that was a healthcare advisor investigator position to an investigator 2 position. It's a lower classification. It created some savings. It allowed us to have someone who could specialize in doing background checks, which did not necessarily involve a need for nursing background and nursing education to perform those kinds of investigations. I took the savings, if you will, from that position, applied them to the other 0.5 equivalent for the office specialist, upgraded that position to a 0.75 administrative assistant, and was able to upgrade the responsibilities of that position in terms of gathering documents, issuing subpoenas, having more responsibility, if you will, in assisting with investigations. So, long answer, Chair Richardson, but yes, those positions did come to the board, and yes, we have used them, but with a, if you will, change in leadership in my area, they were utilized slightly differently, but still with the same goals in mind.
Okay, and now we're back again.
Yes, sir.
And this time, purpose of this package is to request two investigators, advisors, positions, and increase one position from 0.75 to a full FTE to fill critical needs in the agency. If the needs are critical today, were they not critical 2 years ago?
Chair Richardson, arguably they were. I think the difference we have now is that we have a database that can help us analyze what our workload is. Historically, these were statistics kept by hand. It did not give us a good sense of, I think the agency always knew we were behind, that we were working like busy beavers, but we were not getting the job done. Clearly, our performance measures indicate that we were not getting the job done. We come before you today with a more mature database that helps us get a handle on what those workload issues really are and to try and find some good solutions within our current means of meeting them.
Okay, I'm looking at the performance measure that deals with investigations, and it says, you know, this is performance measure number 9, percent of cases investigated and referred to the board within 120 days of receipt of the complaint, and in 2002 it was 18%. 2003, 31%, 2004, 21%. So we have a 10% drop in 1 year and a target of 98%. Could you explain, one, why the 10% drop, and two, why you think that two more investigators will allow you to make up 70%, or in other words, increase your efficiency by 300%?
Chair Richardson, in my wildest dreams it will. In fact, the numbers support more than two, as has been noted before. But we are looking to stay within the resources that we currently have. We're looking for incremental, not just throwing bodies at this. We're looking for efficiencies that we can continue to develop. So that's the back end of your question. As to the performance measures, again, the database was not mature enough to be able to generate the kinds of numbers that you're seeing for today. In fact, it was with some, with great deal of honesty, but some trepidation that we revised the performance measures that had been previously submitted. Since I can't say earlier, and we had to change them downward because if we looked at what the data was actually showing us, it was not meeting that. So we went back and we, you know, kind of swallowed our pride, if you will, and said, okay, here's what they are. The decrease is just the continuum. We're just getting so overwhelmed. We are getting further and further. And frankly, in my opinion, if we keep going at this rate, we're just going to hit a point where things are just going to grind to a halt. We have focused a great deal of our attention on the nursing shortage and processing applications. You may recall I have described the universe of investigations that we do, that some of them are background and then some of them are conduct. The 120-day cases that this performance measure measures are the conduct cases. It does not measure the background checks. Because of the nursing shortage and the need to process people either initially through or renewal through, we had been placing a greater priority on getting those competent people out there able to practice. Therefore, we kind of switched our focus to that. That comes at a risk, frankly. It comes at a cost because it means we're being less timely with those conduct cases. There's that balance. What's more important? Where do we put our resources? That's the question we have been struggling with. And this is where we are today. We're hitting it at 21%. That's woefully insufficient for those conduct cases. We are getting the applications processed through in a more timely fashion, but it's leaving those conduct cases lagging behind.
You know, it's difficult for us. Realize we assume you're doing a great job. We're just doing what needs to be done to bore in on this. But we have no benchmarks. And so it's kind of been brought up before, and I don't recall seeing any kind of comparison as to how what we're doing compares with similar boards of nursing in other states as far as the investigations. I mean, they have to do the same thing that you have to do, and so can you give us that information?
I can, Chair Richardson. It was a question you had brought up earlier, and I did some research on it and thought it would come up again in our conversation. Here's what I was able to find out, if you will. The National Council of State Boards of Nursing did a survey. It's based on the 2000-2002 data. This is something they're undertaking to do periodically, and I think Joan can correct me on this. They're doing one now that would be up to date through this year, and then they're going to start doing it annually, every other year. So I recognize that there's a time lag here, but it's the best comparative national information I can find. With respect to the average numbers of investigations per investigator, the national average for 2002 was 107. Our average was 92. In 2002. What we're doing now in 2004 is 120. We have increased our production, if you will. And I like to think, perhaps this is patting myself on the back, no doubt it is, but I like to think it's because of some of those efficiencies we were able to implement in terms of restaffing and restructuring some of the staffing.
By the way, congratulations on the increase. That's a substantial increase.
It truly is, and I will take that as a compliment to my staff and take that back to them. This point of comparison does not include background checks, because not all other jurisdictions do background checks the way this board does, so that is leaving those out of the picture. The complaint process, if you will, was scaled on a measure of 1 to 4, 1 being the best in a number of factors, and our process was held up against other states' processes, and we were above the national average in that. I can go through what those categories are if you would like, but they were things in terms of the fairness of the process, following established process, communicating status of complaint, provided needed assistance, and the overall quality of the process.
Wouldn't it have been appropriate to have typed that up and provided that to us before this meeting?
Yes, sir. It probably would have.
Okay, so why don't we go... these are just, at this point, they're just words. I mean, it's... because we can't see how we do. How do we stack up? How do we stack up with the national standards or a survey?
In summary, Chair Richardson, we are doing better with what we have, but we have less than what others have. I mean, we have less investigators per number of complaints that we have dealing with. We're making more of the personnel that we have. We lag behind in our time in getting them completed. It's really no surprise. But overall, we are still providing a fair process. It's just a long process for complainants and licensing.
And Mr. Chair, just as an example, one of the nurses had brought an allegation had been brought to her, and she had found out, and I'm not sure how she had found out, but it had taken so long before the board could actually let her know what the allegations were, and that's just because of the number of, there's just not enough investigators to take care of that. And that's very hard on a nurse who knows an allegation has been brought on, and it takes, 4 to 6 weeks maybe before you can really bring the nurse in and start, so that she can start preparing her case regarding any allegations.
Let's digress for just a moment and have you address that. With the Bar Association, if there's an allegation against an attorney, it's made in writing. The processing then, whoever is doing the investigation sends that to the attorney and says, this is a charge that's been made against you. What is your response? And then they do an investigation. My understanding of the nursing investigation is that if there's an allegation made against a nurse, the nurse is not informed of that, but an investigation begins that she then hears about from other people, and it causes a tremendous amount of angst, obviously it would, and an apparent lack of due process, since they don't have the ability to respond to the allegation until after there may already be a determination of what the outcome is going to be.
If I may, please respond to that, Chair Richardson. The comparison to how the state bar works. Our complaint process by statute is confidential. The name of the complainant is confidential, not subject to disclosure. We get a number of complaints. We recognize, I should say, that complaints coming in the door are allegations. We will take a cursory view of that to see if it's even something we need to be looking at. It may end right there, and yes, the licensee will never be the wiser, and the public would never be the wiser that this complaint had been made. My understanding for the reasoning behind that is because of the insurance panels and how they vet persons that they will reimburse is just the fact of a complaint. Whether it was ever substantiated, whether it was dismissed, whether it led to a violation is enough to knock someone off the panel. So that our investigative process is kept confidential. So that is very different. I don't believe there are any bar equivalents of that, but perhaps I am wrong.
We also have a PLF, so it's not like it affects insurance for attorneys just to have an allegation made.
But yes. Our process is not made public, if you will, until a determination that there has potentially been a violation. That is not made until after the licensee involved has been talked with and has had an opportunity to bring anything forward they want to. That's still even prior to the hearing process.
All right, so you're saying that there's a preliminary evaluation, and if there isn't substantial reason to accept it, it just is dropped so it doesn't go on anybody's record, but that if it looks like there may be substance, then it's the allegation is taken to the nurse and they have an opportunity to respond before there's before it goes much further?
Yes, absolutely, sir. Our process is to, as an investigative process, is to gather documents that would be relevant to the allegation, to interview any witnesses that might be relevant to the investigation, and then to finally talk to the licensee. We try and get a context of what happens. Again, we may determine even before we get to the licensee that this is not a violation. Again, the matter can be closed without the licensee even knowing about it. Unfortunately, although we tell people when we issue subpoenas for personnel records or medical records, and we ask witnesses that we're talking to not start rumoring around, we have no control over that. And we try and be very respectful of the licensee and their angst level, if you will, and the process. But our process is to then have the licensee come talk to us or the applicant and explain from their perspective what's been happening. They have an opportunity to have legal counsel with them at that time if they so choose, although they don't have to.
Okay.
And it's only then it goes to the disciplinary and due process.
All right. Thank you for that explanation.
Sure.
Back to the request for additional investigators. It seems to me that if you have surveys that are performed by a national organization that indicate where at least averages are, and maybe for individuals, other individual states who are doing the same kinds of work that we're doing, that information would be either very useful, would be very useful, whether it's positive or negative toward the outcome of the request. That we ought to see that. I would think the co-chairs would want to see it.
And Chair Richardson, I'm happy to provide that with one caveat, and that is this was information that was gathered by the National Council. The only information we're privy to is the aggregate information. We're not privy to other individual boards' findings. We were given, it's as if they collected the entire United States, and we could see what the aggregate came out to be, and we could see how our one piece of it came out, but we were not privy to, say, how Washington's individual report came out, or California or Idaho's, but we're very happy to provide you with the aggregate and our findings once related to our state.
These types of requests made in some other agencies, and they have taken the initiative to contact their counterparts in the adjoining states and asking them for information, and then coming up with, as the nurses have done when the question was brought up about reciprocity and those kinds of things. I mean, you were very responsive in determining where Oregon stood with other states. And it would be useful if we had that kind of information on the investigation process, the number of complaints, the number of staff, those kinds of things, because it would allow a more logical and reasonable comparison. And then if there's a difference, it gives you a chance to explain why you would think that this difference would arise. If that could be provided for us, I think that would be very helpful in being able to determine this.
Chair Richardson, we are happy to renew our attempts to do that. We tried doing that as I was gathering this information and were unable to get that information for you, but we will be happy to try again.
All right. Other questions about the investigation, the package requesting additional investigators?
I appreciate this line of questioning. I would like to see the comparisons, I think. And if you can contact individual states, I think that be great, because usually what we find, compliments to you, is we stack up pretty well. That'd be helpful.
Okay, thank you. Are there other items that need to be discussed? I brought up before that as I looked at your layout of assignments, work assignments, that as I see manager to staff ratios, I'm looking at one manager to less than three staff, which is somewhat more concentrated than the private sector. Do you have any response on that?
Chair Richardson, if I may, I did a little work on this yesterday so I could explain it better. I looked at manager supervisory, manager non-supervisory, and classified. Most of our managers are non-supervisory. Even myself, even though I supervise one person, I'm a manager because of the nature of my work, policy setting, and running the program within the agency. That, and I don't have it right next to me, there is a definition in the Department of Administrative Services personnel rules as to what kind of work should be a management person versus a classified person. And so we actually have four individuals who are management supervisory positions. Joan, of course, as the director, supervises the five individuals who are doing administrative type tasks, if you will, such as myself. And she also supervises the two, I always call them the corner offices, the people with the largest numbers, people such as Kim, program execs, and
the corner cubicles.
Well, that's true. One has an office and one has a cubicle right now. She also supervises the consulting group, and there's five individuals in that. So she has, seven people working for one individual in this case. And she's also keeping track of the board itself of nine individuals. The licensing and certification manager, licensing customer services division manager, there are 18 people including himself. So he's supervising 17 people. He does have one manager who's supervising under him. That is the call center manager, and that person supervises six people. So we have the call center and then right above that licensing and certification. So I suppose directly he is supervising 17 minus 6 is 11. So he's supervising 11 individuals. And then we have the program exec for investigation and compliance, which is Kim, and she is supervising all of the investigators. There are 12 of those, including there are not 12 investigators, excuse me.
Yes.
There are 12 people in that area. Three of those are clerical staff. So she has, and this is, I'm talking about if you gave us what's in our request. You can subtract out as you wish. We're hoping you won't. And she also supervises the three-person nurse monitoring program. They're the people who help rehabilitate or work with people who are rehabilitating. So she has a division that we are
hoping we'll have 16 people in it, so she is supervising 15 people. And that equals our total of 45.
Right. So the answer is that some are actually managing and others, because of the nature of job description, qualify for those positions under DAS
correct. Standards. They are impacting policy, such as the consultants who are stating policy for example, all the CNAs in the state. That individual is a management service employee, non-supervisory. And we do have 9 non-supervisory managers because of policy. And some of them are doing policy within the agency, such as myself, the human resources manager. That certainly is logical. And then others are working with individual groups, such as our consultants. And they are writing the OARs and providing practice knowledge to both the board and to the nurses of the state.
So once again, it goes back to DAS.
We do comply with their rules, sir.
We need to talk to Representative Crummell.
Right. Have a good day back there, Jim.
All right. Are there other questions for these qualified witnesses? Okay. All right.
I have one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you, and I know we've had conversation about this, but could you comment once again on your projected ending balance and the number of months operating budget that might be?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, yes. In sheer numbers, just the basic math, our ending balance as projected would be just a fraction under 3.5 months. We do have the unusual case of, if you will, floating the CNA program. We have to wait until the accounting month closes, and then we have to bill the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division to reimburse us for the CNA program. And in order to do that, we don't just get the matching funds. We actually send them our matching funds when we bill them, and then they reimburse us. So the effect of that is that we have about about a 45-day float. I think I have that in the presentation. The program float is about $227,000, and then we also have to plan as an agency for, and I know this is unknown, but if we were to, any time we do receive negotiated pay raises, it comes after the legislative session, and those are dealt with in an e-board, so we have to have money on hand for that. So that lowers our ending balance to under 2.5 months in practical.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation today. Now we...
Mr. Chair?
We will invite up Brian DeBlachmidt, but before we do, Senator West.
On some of the comparative data, do you guys have any idea how long it would take you guys to get that and correlate? Just so we can set an expectation.
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland, are you referring to the disciplinary comparisons?
An investigation?
Yes.
Or any other information you can get?
Yes. We'll get right on that. In fact, if you were talking to the viewing audience, I'm hoping the viewing audience and one person in particular in our office has already started making those phone calls back again. So, but probably within a week.
Okay. That works. I mean, don't want to hold you. I'd just for purposes of scheduling and chairing that.
The national information I can get in a better form for you rather than my notes, and we will endeavor to make contact with regional states first, and if that's not successful, we'll start moving up from there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLeichman. I represent the Oregon Nurses Association and have done so for 27 years now, going on 28. So I have a little history, not only the board, but also nursing in the state. And as we've gone through this number of days of phase one and phase two, I just had a couple of notations that I had made that I think really need to be reflected on, or at least commented on by the Oregon Nurses Association. Let me start by commenting a little bit about the shortage. And I know there's been a lot of discussion with the Board of Nursing about the nursing shortage and what they're doing about it, why we didn't know about it. Let me tell you that nursing in the state has been screaming from the top of their lungs about the impending disaster that is approaching on the shortage for a number of sessions. And if I may go back, I chuckle as a rookie lobbyist. My first sessions, I would always laugh at the lobbyists that said, well, I remember the session of 65, and this is what we did or didn't do. But I do remember some very early sessions. And when we went through the economic downturn of the early 80s, this legislature, in an effort to balance budgets in four special sessions, made some determinations that I think we're seeing play out right now. We made cuts in nursing programs, and in particular the Oregon Health Science University, that cut the number of baccalaureate nursing students per class in half in the early 80s. We are now seeing the fallout from those decisions. So I guess the message to you now is not only how cuts impact long-term in this particular area, but we need to look longer-term at what we potentially can do now that may help us get ourselves back out of this. The second comment I guess I would have is from personal experience. I've been hearing for years that we have an entire volume of qualified nursing student applicants, and we just don't have the space for them. Well, that really hit home in the last 3 or 4 months. My niece has been trying to get into nursing school for about 4 or 5 years. This is a young lady that's 26 years old, is not a fresh-faced high school graduate. She was a straight-A student in high school, had taken a number of college classes and has been working part-time and taking classes now for 8 years. She finally was admitted, and I guess I can take a little credit. I tried to call in some favors. She was one of 20 students admitted to a program that had 800 qualified applicants. So that's the kind of scenario that we're seeing right now. The next comment I would like to make, and I appreciate
that, Brian, would you give us the benefit of your experience on what really needs to be done to make the training in nursing more available to people in Oregon?
Not being a nurse and obviously having witnessed a lot of this, but I do know that there's a lot of very good work going on by the Oregon Nurse Leadership Coalition, which I know has been referenced before. ONA is involved in that, as are the deans of the schools, the community college folks, the Board of Nursing, the Center for Nursing. And we are moving forward in what we think is the right game plan to make up some of those shortages. One of the things that has always troubled me, and I think we're moving a little bit closer in that direction, is that I don't know that we've ever asked the right questions. And I had a conversation with Senator Bates after our last hearing when he was talking about the Hill versus community colleges. I don't know that we've ever asked the question, what is not only the right number that we need, but what is the right mix? Do we need, how many baccalaureate folks do we need? How many doctorally prepared folks do we need in order to have educators? How many nurse practitioners do we need to be turning out? I don't know that we've fully moved to there yet, but I think that's something that the ONLC and the Center for Nursing is attempting to do now, and it is very encouraging. The second answer to your question, Chair Richardson, is that when I started in this lobbying field for nurses in the 70s and 80s, the community colleges and the baccalaureate programs didn't even talk to each other. They were so at odds about which program's correct, which one program is the right one, which, you know, graduation rates, passage rates, that they didn't even talk to each other. And the ability for a nursing student to transfer from one program to another was just about non-existent. The ability for a nurse that would go to a community college and then want to transfer even some credits to the Hill just didn't happen. That is not the case anymore in most instances. They have come a long way, but there is a lot to be done yet, and I think the OLMNC and the Center for Nursing are two of the places that the focus has been on. And I would, I guess, encourage you, because I think the right solution for getting us out of this has to come from the nursing community. I think they need to be telling you what it is they need, and I think they're getting there, and they will continue to communicate through me and others as to what their needs are. The next thing I'd like to comment about was the investigative process, and I know that I have talked to several of you about some issues related to investigations, and Chair Richardson, I know you asked at least one question, probably because of the conversation that we had had in relationship to how the bar handles investigations versus the Board of Nursing. I want to let you know that ONA and the Board of Nursing staff have had at least one conversation and actually a couple of conversations since that last hearing, and we're trying to work through those issues. While we now believe that we have a clearer understanding of what it is they do as far as investigations and their hearings process that are solving some of the issues that I had raised with you as individual members, we are still having some conversations as to some potential sticking points and some potential solutions, and I wanted to convey that to the full committee that we are trying to work through that and are hopeful that we'll get to a place where we're comfortable with the process. And I do understand, and the ONA acknowledges that one of the major problems is the delay in the investigations, as Senator Montes Anderson has indicated, that when a nurse either through the grapevine hears that somebody's asking questions about their practice, or even from the point of their first contact with the board, as far as they are under investigation, they're aware of that, the time that lapses is not only very stressful to them, but it also is confusing to them as to where are we in the process and when can we get this over with. And so I guess the answer to the question of whether ONA has a position on the additional investigative positions and the board positions would be that if it helps shorten the duration, then we would be supportive of that. With that, I'll answer any questions, but I want this committee to know, as the same way as the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, that we are always available to you, whether it's issues about the nursing shortage or positions that we would take on board budget or any other bills. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marsteadison. Yes.
Mr. Gilashman, what was the bill that we sent out of my committee to Ways and Means? Do you remember the bill number? 1,000-something.
Quiz.
Yeah.
1,020...
1016, the surcharge bill?
Yes. I just wanted to bring that to the attention to the committee, because I don't know how that fits into the overall Ways and Means process since this is new. But we, out of my Senate Health Policy Committee, sent Senate Bill 1016 that would basically add a charge or a fee, $20.
Surcharge. And
surcharge.
I'm glad, and I'll comment about that.
Okay.
In a minute.
A surcharge that would be designated into a fund in which schools or, well, a variety of different organizations could apply for this money to help advance the nursing practice or the shortage. Do you want to comment any more on that? And anyway, I wanted to know how that fit in with the nurses' budget, too, because this is something that nurses are willing to, okay, if we can't get money anywhere else, let us as nurses start a fund to help try to address the nursing shortage problem. Since we did pass Senate Bill 800 two sessions ago, Senator Nelson and I sponsored that, but it didn't have a fund. And so now we're looking at
a dollar. Funding.
Well, it had a dollar, yes. All right, go ahead and respond.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually I think mentally I'd made a note to discuss that. As you had indicated, the bill that passed last session that established the Center for Nursing, and I was the person that gave the dollar in the Ways and Means process last time to get them on the board, because there wasn't even a dollar allocated from Ways and Means. But the bill that you talked about, 1016, and it's my understanding that the Board of Nursing has taken recent action in order to support that, the other players in the OLNC have had discussions about that bill and the format. And there's still some discussions as to the actual use of those dollars and how it's administered and a variety of things like that, I think the significant thing that Senator Montes Anderson is indicating to you is that nursing is crying out for dollars, and they don't see that allocation coming from sources other than themselves at this point. And if it were to help the nursing shortage, at least get us farther down the track on the kinds of questions that I was raising, which is the mix and clinical settings and even assisting some programs, they're willing to assess a surcharge on their own license to get us going down that path, and that's what that bill is all about.
And Mr. Chair, yes, we only have to pay $85 every 2 years for our license also. That's one thing about the Board of Nursing, really trying to watch the amount of dollars that nurses have to pay for licensure. But $85, $42.50 a year is certainly not an exorbitant amount to pay for your license, too. So I just wanted to put that on the record, too.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, too, I actually had cautioned the Board of Nursing after you asked the question about during one of the last past sessions about, is this as high as the fees are going to go during the next biennium? And I had hoped that the clarification of that potential surcharge, which is a bill that nursing is bringing on themselves, could be understood and differentiated between the fee and a potential surcharge that a separate bill would set for the purposes of dealing with the nursing shortage. And hopefully, with that out on the table, everybody will understand that that's not a fee increase, but that obviously is an increase in what someone might pay.
Would it be a mandatory fee or surcharge as compared to, here's the bill, it's $85 plus, we request that you authorize 20 for this?
Mandatory.
Yeah,
mandatory.
It's my understanding, and I haven't looked at I wasn't the lead lobbyist on dealing with 1016, but it's my understanding it's an add-on, so... Mm-hmm. People could reflect on that and say, well, the fee I'm paying is 85 plus 20, so it's really 105. But the distinction we're trying to make is that there is a specific purpose for that $20.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but a comment. I come from an industry, plumbing industry, where the training and the workforce development for the whole industry is based on a surcharge on where every plumber works. I mean, I don't know the exact amount now, but it's like 30 cents an hour. That, although it would appear as a deduction on the employee, it's actually paid for by the employer, and it's jointly administered. And that's how the industry continues to renew itself and train people. And I would think possibly some type of discussions in terms of whether there should be specific training fees paid into a fund because renewing that industry and renewing that workforce in nursing is incredibly expensive, but it's a cost of the industry and whether it's being paid for by a nurse's license or by patient fees or a patient surcharge, or the whole industry needs to come together to help help pay for it. I was involved with a health issue a few years ago, and I was talking to one of the young nurses that was involved with my wife's care, and she was just getting ready to graduate from nursing school or had just graduated, and had incurred thousands upon thousands of dollars of debt, which, again, I don't know if you can, if the fairest way of training people is by indebting the people coming into the profession. If it is, it's still a cost that's going to be incurred through the labor costs for over their career. And so there might be a more rational way to do this so that we could have, you know, solve the problem long term like you're suggesting, rather than have it dependent upon whatever the budgetary situation in the state of Oregon is on a year-by-year basis.
Mr. Chair, I know there's limited time, but I have two just like 30-second comments. One is there is some very innovative things happening out in the community. You have new partnerships with schools of nursing and specific facilities or groups of facilities in which they, if the person agrees to go to work for that facility for a duration after their graduation, then the facility or the organization takes care of most of their obligations as far as their student loans and so forth. I know there's several of those, and there's growing numbers. And obviously, I think it's a recognition by facilities that the way to get that workforce coming in is they have to make an investment, and they have to buy in, and it's cheaper for them to do that than it is for them to go unstaffed or to have to pay very extensive recruiting and turnover costs. So there are those kinds of innovative programs.
Mr. Blanchment, are all nurses members of the ONA?
No, sir.
What's the percentage on that?
Yeah, I think we represent, I haven't seen the current numbers, but roughly between 7,000 and 8,000 RNs in this state. Now, there are also LPNs that are not members of ONA by our charter. I mean, we are an RN organization. There are facilities in the state in which RNs do not have recognition in the labor organization. Salem Hospital is one. So, and then there are also advanced practice nurses like nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists who may or may not be represented or in a bargaining unit, but also are members. So it's kind of a multi-purpose organization.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Is there any concluding remarks?
No, that's it. And I thank you for your indulgence. I've been sitting through this, and I felt maybe the 27 years of kind of a little history might be helpful.
It has been. We appreciate very much.
Thank you.
Your time. All right. Are there any other matters that need to come up for the subcommittee? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Thank you.